Okay, so we're going to take a little different turn here and talk about food systems, local agriculture, things associated with healthy food access in that regard. Nothing to disclose here either. Collaborators, and a lot of this work, I'm sort of a cheerleader, encouraging it and supporting it, and not necessarily the prime person. Ben Chapman is a colleague of mine at NC State who's a food safety specialist and is doing quite a bit of this work. And then Melissa Cunningham, who's a CDC prevention specialist, a doctoral student, Ashley, and then I'll be talking about our Sustainable Local Food Advisory Council. So just a reminder that local food has become popular, trendy. I think a big question in a lot of people's mind is, but is it reaching everybody, or is it a kind of high-end, niche, trendy kind of thing? So my particular research interest is the intersection between healthy, local, sustainable food and food access and food insecurity. So, of course, everyone has heard recently about a lot of food safety concerns. There have been a number of big outbreaks that have gotten lots of attention, the most recent one being the cantaloupes. Lots of angst about both the loss of life, the illness, and then, of course, the cost, $150 million here. And so what are the implications of these food safety issues for healthy food access? Well, it may be surprising for some of you to know that fruits and vegetables are actually the source of a lot of the big outbreaks. Actually, if you think about the news stories recently, you know, we tend to think, oh, it's the hamburgers and the mayonnaise and things like that, and actually fresh produce is a major source. So this has resulted in some tighter federal regulations. That it's been a fairly recent process. It's been ongoing. It certainly has heightened fear among consumers. Interesting to follow the blogs, like with the cantaloupes, the local food people were saying, oh, but it was a big producer, and then other people coming back and say, well, but they were blaming on the fact that it came from local sources. So lots of back and forthing on that. And I think one of the things that's caused some concern, especially in the local food movement, is that the food safety regulations may not be tailored to the size and the scope of the operation. In fact, our Senator Hagan, you may have heard of the Hagan Tester Amendment to the federal legislation that did try to make some adjustments to make that more practical. So the three things I'm going to be addressing are GAP certification, that's good agricultural practices, school garden food served in cafeterias, and then briefly mentioned salad bars in schools as well. So just a snapshot of a website for beginning farmers, lots of concern and anxiety about the GAP standards. We still don't know what they will mean for small farmers. This is the website from the North Carolina Sustainable Local Food Advisory Council. We are about a year and a half old. I serve on the Council. It's legislatively appointed statewide. I highlighted the kind of purpose there, which is actually kind of nice to read every now and then. I won't read it all to you, but it mentions local economy, creating jobs, stimulating statewide economic development, preserving open space, reducing carbon emissions, preserving and protecting the natural environment, increasing consumer access to fresh nutritious food and providing greater food security for all North Carolinians. So this sounds like it came straight from the School of Public Health, but actually it's a fairly ag-dominated, and the Commissioner of Agriculture, who is a fairly conservative Republican, is the director of it, actually somewhat balanced by the co-chair, who is Nancy Kremer, who's heads up the Center for Environmental Farm Systems. She doesn't carry quite the clout that he does on the committee. But I don't know if you can see down below, you see a lot of the issues that have been focused on relate to very much ag-oriented resolutions about exempting small-scale processing of agricultural products from wastewater permit requirements. Now, that sounds a little odd, but it's things like there's a lot of wineries growing up in North Carolina, and that was considered wastewater when they just cooled some of their things, so they had to go through all kinds of things to get rid of that wastewater. So I'm finding that in this area, a lot of the policy things relate to removing barriers rather than sort of, which actually goes over a lot better than requiring things, especially in the sort of nanny state environment. So as part of the council, we had testimony from a small organic farmer. He was only 5'2". No, well, I realized when I read that it looked a little funny. And what he said to us was that it would cost him about $12,000 annually to be certified under the GAP certification. That should be capitalized GAP. And the costs mainly add up in terms of inspector charges, and it's not very well regulated or controlled, so they can add up quickly, of high charge per hour plus travel, and there are just a few of them in the state, so there's a lot of travel costs. And the big kicker is that each crop has to be certified individually, and so if you have 1,000 acres of corn, it's one thing, but if you have 20 different fruits and vegetables, each one has to be certified separately, and that can really add up in terms of costs. So this ends up being a significant barrier to small farmers growing multiple crops. So the council, our council last year recommended that we develop an all-farm good agricultural practices pilot program for farmers to try to look at whether, you know, what the burden is on the farmers realistically, and actually whether we could take an approach that would certify a whole farm rather than this kind of individual approach. So these are some of the objectives of the study, and again, Ben Chapman, the food safety expert, is one of the main leaders here. So first was to identify barriers to implementing GAP currently, both perceived and real, because we know that some of this is probably as much perceived as real. And we defined the farm sizes, less than 15 acres of produce, which is still pretty good size for produce, and at least 6 commodities. And then also looking at barriers to attaining GAP certification, either USDA or private, and then do an economic analysis for implementing GAP and choosing whether to become certified or not. And all of this is work that's ongoing. And then after the data are collected, the idea is to try to actually, you know, use that to address the barriers and come up with practical solutions to producers across the state. And this is a problem in a lot of states as well, so we're hoping this may be useful elsewhere as well. And other efforts are going on in other states. And then host some regional information meetings to try to educate both the producers and the buyers. Buyers are starting to say, well, everything has to be GAP certified, just because they think that's a way to protect themselves from any liability. But there's more to it than that, and they need to be aware of the issues as well. And then try to create recognition program for marketing food strategy to buyers so that you can help the producers to be able to demonstrate the food safety. And then finally, recommendations for how things could be adjusted over time in this certification process, and then a framework to modify or adjust requirements as needed, and then tools and tips and strategies for implementation. So I chair the subcommittee called Health, Wellness, Hunger, and Food Access. That was actually a combination of two subcommittees that were so small that we joined forces. It does represent that the nutrition side of things is very small on this council, but so we try to get behind things that are kind of ag-related that will support our efforts. And our Department of Public Instruction recently started requiring that all farms participating in Farm to School be GAP certified. And USDA doesn't necessarily recommend this, but our school system's taking a more conservative approach. And there's more and more call for GAP certification, and some farmers' markets are beginning to wonder if this is going to be required as well. So we recommended that as a way to kind of overcome this barrier until the whole farm certification is set up and running is to for the General Assembly to provide supplemental funds to help with the GAP certification. So switching gears a little bit to school gardens, and this was a presentation that Melissa gave to our subcommittee of the Food Policy Council. It was a fairly lively discussion because our Department of Public Instruction, again, is quite conservative about this. Many states actually ban the consumption of school garden food in school cafeterias. How many of you are in states where that's the case? So, not so many. But often the same schools will allow taste testing in classrooms of that school garden food, so it seems kind of contradictory. And then salad bars are often discouraged by health inspectors. We're actually finding that state-level regulations are being overinterpreted at the local level, and so salad bars are being pulled out when the state folks are actually thinking that they would be fine. There is some concern about extra burden on child nutrition staff, but ultimately it seems like fear of liability is the biggest concern. So we did kind of an informal survey around other states. I'm just listing a few things there. This has been about a year ago, so there may be changes. I'm interested in hearing from anybody who's had particular experience here. The common sort of protocol food safety themes are around soil testing, water source, any kind of chemicals, hand washing, And just quickly, in terms of what's stated at the higher levels, basically Congress has sort of pushed USDA to do more with school garden food. So it's a little bit contradictory in that regard. In fact, if anyone participated in some of the People's Garden grants, you know, that required school gardens food to be served in the cafeteria. So we have this contrast going on. And we talked to USDA, although I think, as it turns out, FDA may be the people we're supposed to be talking to. But USDA, if you look down here at the bottom here, basically they say, yes, there are safety issues, but talk to your local folks about that. So nobody's coming up with sort of national guidance on this. So in terms of what is recommended, lots of different states are doing interesting things around this. And we're trying to collect some of those to see what might be a good way to go. I think in terms of lessons that we've learned in North Carolina, I think the big one is that fear of liability is the biggest concern, both in terms of school garden foods and salad bars. As I mentioned, sometimes the salad bar guidelines are overinterpreted at the local level. School nutrition staff and administration want realistic guidelines so that they can say that, you know, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. And legal advice that we've sought says basically the fear of liability is kind of overblown, but if people follow basic guidelines, they should be okay. So I got a race here. Current and next steps are to assess gardening practices at schools, because we don't know a lot about that, and then pilot some realistic recommendations. And so again, my colleague Ben Chapman is doing this work. We've had some interesting balancing act discussions. As I say, if you look at this, it shows that they're talking about the first line is wearing plastic gloves when in the garden. And I think I convinced him to consider whether or not we could make hand washing the default, and then, if necessary, the gloves. And also, I think he doesn't garden a lot, because I said, well, what about if you're just going out there to weed and put your hands straight in the dirt? Do you need to wash your hands? Well, maybe not. Maybe that's more for collecting the produce. So, you know, it's hard to figure out exactly how to interpret all of this, but we have to be careful. And here are my conclusions and recommendations are that I think initially small farmers were a little bit too quick to say, well, we're small, we don't need to worry about food safety, and I think that's come around, and I think that we're on the right track there, but it needs to be tailored to the situation like we've described with the gap. And certainly we need to hear and respect concerns about liability, but not let these things shut the whole effort down, and I think that's what's happened in a lot of places, that people aren't doing school gardens because they can't use the food. And then we need to identify and disseminate evidence-based practices, but make sure they're realistic. Like, one could argue, because some of the food safety concerns have been from animals, that every school garden should have a 7-foot fence. Well, if that was required, that would probably eliminate that from happening. So, questions. This was a fun sign I found in my father's hometown. I wrote about this wine. And they're so widely varying by state that hopefully we can learn from each other about the challenge. Steve can ask. Oh. Okay, over here. Yeah, taste testing and make sure you rinse them off, and you don't really get into any. think that's a good question. Now, I do think there are some school gardens across the country that are providing a fairly reasonable amount of food, but I agree, for the most part, it's pretty small. I think it's more for the sake of the kids and overcoming neophobia, you know, actually trying new things and being proud of producing the food. As someone pointed out, what kind of message does it send to the kids if we have a school garden, they grow their food, and then essentially they're told that it's not safe to eat it? I mean, that's kind of the message that they're getting. So, you know, I would envision it as a bowl of salad that's been produced from the garden. I don't think, some of the child nutrition directors have said they're concerned about it disrupting their menu planning and that kind of thing. But I think it's going to tend to be so small that it could be easily integrated. But then if you have that barrier, I think it's more psychological and social than it is, you know, that it's a major source of food. Oh, yeah, Steve.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
What's your sense of the federal role here? I mean, to kind of simplify stuff, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's what we've been trying to do. In fact, we had several discussions with USDA folks to see if they'd be willing to put out some sort of general recommendation, and they seem to keep backing away from that and saying, talk to your local people. But then I met some FDA folks at another conference, and it seems like they may be the ones to do this.
So it's still up in the air as to who.
Yeah, because really USDA is more meat, and FDA is more the non-meat. So.